Blog Talk Radio.
When you control a man's thinking, you do not have to worry about his actions. You do not have to tell him not to stand here or go yonder. He will find his proper place, and he will stay in it. You do not need to send him to the back door. He will go without being told. In fact, if there is no back door, he will cut one for his special benefit. His education makes it necessary. Carter G. Woodson, Miseducation of the Negro.
Yeah.
Hey, 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 good evening, good afternoon, or good morning. It just depends on what part of the world you are listening. Oki, namaste, hola, welcome. Another episode of the Greenhouse Effect Radio Show. My name is Will Green, holding down one half of your hosting duties. Live every Thursday on blogtalkradio.com/the Greenhouse Effect. It is Thursday, June 10th, 2021. As I mentioned, my name is Will Green. Holding down the other half of our hosting duties is me papa, my best friend, the Lions historian, Bill Green. What's happening, Daddy-O? Good evening.
Man, it's hot out here. I had to mute my phone to get myself right, because I tell you again, you caught me off guard. Man, I love that. That is, talk to me a little sequelly, man. Let me stop thinking about it. I'll spend the next hour or so laughing, man. But it's so appropriate. It's so apropos. It says, you know, I mean, it doesn't, nothing can say it more profoundly than those three or four words, you know.
Wake up, goddammit! Petey Green!
You know, man, that is just, you know, man, that is so right on. So what's happening, man? I don't know, man. things are kind of out of inside of me, internally, things are really out of control in a controllable way. It's just so much that I'm being reminded of. You know, it's hard to keep up with what's going on with me when the media is so distracting with what's going on with them. And I'm becoming more and more aware of the fact that rarely do I track with the media. I think probably the most consistent time I did was during Obama's stretch while he was running for president. I learned something from cable news, you know, that their tendency is to build up that which they favor, only to eventually tear it down and then to build it back up again. And I've watched that pattern play out more and more in the cable outlet news mediums, you know. And so that one taught me that. But at the same time, that was really my introduction, my baptism under fire, if you will, with cable news. I really was not that – I wasn't involved with it at all until I was on the East Coast staying for about a week or so at your cousin Art's place while he was being ordained a deacon. And two things I had never watched that I watched while I was at his place feverently. I watched the court shows, which I had never watched, and cable news, starting out with Chris Matthews, who I didn't like. And I only changed my attitude because Art said he was cool. I didn't agree, but it kind of took the edge off. It kind of made me a little bit tolerant of his spin. But anyway, that was my introduction to MSNBC. And cable news became a staple for me as far as having an understanding of, to whatever degree I can, having an understanding of how white media operates. I don't care who works for them. You know, white media, its owners, has its own way of manipulating the news. About, I don't even know how long ago it was, maybe about 20 years, maybe longer, 25, maybe. Faraya Chadea, and I may be mispronouncing her name, Pulitzer Prize winner who for a while worked with wrote for the Washington Post, I think. She wrote a book called Who Monitors the Media? And, you know, and right in the opening of the book, it just, you know, it just really sparked my attitude, you know, because it required me to think deeper than what I wanted to believe. You know, like I was raised like you were kind of raised. You know, I was raised on three stations of the news that, you know, pretty much broadcast the same thing. It was just who you liked is the station you watch. But they all pretty much, you know, whether it was CBS, NBC, or ABC, they pretty much all talked from the same spin. And they had their favorites. And, of course, we had ours, you know, whether it was Walter Cronkite, whether it was Walter Jacobson, Bill Curtis, you know, the sports guys. I really liked Wendell Smith before I even knew that he was the writer who did most of the writing that made Jackie Robinson a standard in Black Homes. You know, but anyway, so this thing right now, you know, it's just got me spun out. And it's hard for me to stay. It's not focused, it's not the word I want to use, because I don't think it's possible for anybody who has a black consciousness mind to be focused. You know, everything is so, you know, out of context. Everything is so convoluted. you know, there's no one thing that you can focus on without it bleeding off into something else, which in turn takes everything out of focus. You know, if you know, there's any degree of consciousness involved with the social exchange that is going on right now. It's a very troubling time, and it's troubling on so many levels. And doggone it, if not for this show, I probably wouldn't be as bent out of shape as I am. But this doggone show messed around and made me start investigating history, you know, one show after another, you know. And it's like no sooner than we would get a grasp on one thing, the media would change the projection. And then, you know, we're off on another tear. But we have our shows archived and we have our notes available. So we can always link back. And when I first started out thinking I knew what I wanted to talk about last week based on the things that started coming out because of the Tulsa deal, right, which is how America likes to dress up its history nice and neat, talk about it today, let's move on tomorrow. Well, it doesn't work for us meaning me and you. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. You know, like you pointed out to me, I don't know where I got it in my head that the massacre in Tulsa happened on Juneteenth. I mean, Juneteenth had enough issues. You know, and you said, nah, man, Memorial Day and the day after. And the dates mean so much, you know, and that's the point of history, right? Without the dates, where's the link? But you can manipulate history if you exclude certain dates. And that wasn't excluded from me as far as current history was concerned. That was my own failure to do due diligence. But it took 100 years before a president went there. And my feeling is only because it was a nice round number, like 60 home runs or some crap, you know. I'm sure that a Barack Obama went there, and I'm sure others did, but not on the day of, you know, the commemoration and things and the whole ceremony. It was never any kind of ceremony like what followed Biden. And so it's like, okay, now, and then just like that, let's move on. Aha. But history messed around and blinked, man. Yeah. Right? And all of a sudden, you know, other things started coming out as history does. You know, history only tolerates being ignored for so long, you know, and eventually time catches up with it. And people start saying stuff that bleeds into other stuff that bleeds into other stuff. Like people started writing about Trump near the end of his run, you know, like how he sounded so much like Nixon and then McCarthy, even some Reagan sprinkled in. But, you know, all of a sudden when you bring those names up, now there's a link to history. Now people start taking a look at the history, and suddenly it's like, wait a minute, these scandals are not old. I mean, are not new. They're old. Wait a minute. Yeah. You know, these issues are not brand new. And then it starts backing up more and more and more. So here we are. So anyway, let me back up a little bit, man, so you can jump back in. See what happens when you ask me how's it going.
What did I say, man? Blame Will. I'm working on my book, man. I'm working on my book.
Yeah, I love that title. You don't know how much I love that title, man.
issues with, brand new. So, Make America Great. And that made me look back like, oh, that's Ronnie Raygun.
And Ronnie Raygun, man. Right on, man. You know,
and then you go back with, what's his boy, Roger Stone, you know, Roger Stone and them, they go back to Nixon, and, you know, and it's like, wow, wait a minute. You know, that's just a brief example.
Spiro T. Agnew, man, don't leave him out of the mix.
Yeah, you know, and that was something that I caught by accident watching a documentary. Wait a minute.
Yeah, man. That's how history reveals itself. You know, these folks think they're putting these shows out just to attract an audience, and all of a sudden somebody does what you did. Then wait a minute. Wait a minute. I ain't going to say the rest of that.
Wait.
Wake up, goddammit.
Wait a minute.
What? Yeah, man. Yeah.
I started thinking about your boy Reuben Carter. you know, and how his story got out.
Yeah, man.
You know, and we, you know, one of the things I admire about your concept of Write Your Own Book Club show is just the premise behind it. Because if you're not writing your story, who is?
Yeah, so, amen, man. Yeah.
You know, so now we look at Black American history. You know, let's expand that a little bit. Let's just talk about us as a whole. Like, who is writing our history? You know, now they're trying to change the history. You know, I've got to review this article about you mentioned who monitors the media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember early doing these shows. Early, you know, trying to research and watch the news and see what's going on. I guess at the time I didn't even know I was connecting the dots. I kind of didn't really know what I was doing. I'm just kind of figuring out, you know, and still am today. But doing this with you kind of narrows the vision, if you will, the goal or what have you, of what we're trying to, what we can present and what we have to offer. But anyway, I remember reading and reading articles, and then I'm going back to the articles, and it seemed like the article changed. It seems like the news changed, you know. They don't really rescind stuff anymore. You don't really hear about retractions. You know, they'll just make the changes without really saying anything. You know, things that, like you say, seem out of context. It's like it's just so sporadic, and it's like you have to really pick your battle. You kind of almost get an idea that you're connecting the dots, but you don't really know that you're connecting the dots because you got to pick your battle. You know, okay, so I'm looking at this Tulsa thing, but now they mention Ludlow and Slocum, but I haven't finished with Tulsa yet. You know, so it's like, how do I keep my head above water and not get too overwhelmed because things are kind of out of context and I got to kind of put it together. But I feel that way too sometimes. That's all I'm saying is that I used to really feel that way at the beginning and trying to figure out how, you know, what context to present on this show. I remember, and I'm kind of just reviewing what you just mentioned earlier, and I remember, I think one of probably really me noticing the news, quote unquote, throwing my two fingers up, noticing the news, was actually when I moved out of Chicago, and not Illinois State, but like Atlanta, and watching the news in a different city, you don't have that sense of familiarity anymore. You know, like you said, you had your 3-4 maybe channels, and you kind of knew what to expect. But now it's like, oh, I'm in this different area, and it is being presented differently. Now, a lot of the scripts are the same. You know, they say, and there's videos that the scripts are all the same. You know, they all say the same thing, no matter what state or city they're in. But it still looks different, and so it caused me to just listen and notice and observe.
Yeah.
But it was
really,
you know, and then moving to Atlanta, I was, you know, CNN was literally, you know, in front of my face every day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So then it was like, well, let's check out this CNN. And so it just kind of grew from there, I think. It just hit me as you were talking about the time that you spent with Deke.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, just reviewing, listening to some of the things that you were saying earlier.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I think we both had the same experience in some way or another, recognizing the power of the media. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I never looked. I mean, it's overwhelming. You know, the control that it has. I always thought of the media as being fair. You know, I just did because they pretty much all talk from the same venue. And I guess my involvement with the news industry had something to do with it.
But wasn't that the initial platform, though, to present a voice of the people, right?
Yeah.
And to, man.
Yeah. 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 Before commercialism took over. And when it took over, you know, as a result of a bill that was passed in the 40s, really, but it really came to life in the 60s, initially the news was supposed to be commercial free. It was supposed to be designated time spent commercial free that did what you just said. It presented the voice of the people, you know, but this bill passed and nobody paid attention to it. And from that moment on, you know, everything that we get from the media is commercial driven. If it's not ratings, it's not news, you know, and that really hurts someone like myself in that the ratings do not reflect history at all. You know, history is a continuum. You know, it's not an abridgment. It's not something that you cover in an hour or two, you know, or for a day, you know, or even for a week. You know, it's a continuum. It's that thing that you mention a lot on the show, connecting the dots. That's what the news is supposed to. The news is supposed to connect the dots of history, you know, and it's supposed to be repetitive. But that doesn't happen. You know, ratings got in the way of that. And so you have shows competing with each other. And that's all it is, competition, like a program like MSNBC competing with a program like Fox News. It has, you know, nothing to do with, you know, the people. It has to do with the ratings as it influences the people, whether truth reigns or not. You know, such a distortion of truth now. You know, even a, you know, outlet I like to watch, you know, I can almost see the prompter that they're reading from and how even a show like MSNBC will adjust the facts just for the sake of the, just for the sake of theater, you know, and of course, depending on who the host is at a given time, you know, some are more theatrical than others, you know, it's really something, man. But anyway, sorry to go on and on with that, bro.
No, you know, another thing, though, that is interesting. And so last week, you know what, wait. So before I start talking about last week, let me just remind our listeners out there, because here on the Greenhouse Effect Radio Show, why use 100 words when 1,000 words will do? We always remind you all to grab a pen and paper, pencil and pad. I like to add a little bit more post-it note marker because my desk be full of post-it notes. So make sure you got something you want to write with.
Wow, this is, yeah.
Because you may have some questions. You may pick up something.
Could you bring it up? Thank you. I'm sorry, Will. Thank you.
No, you're good. I just got hungry all of a sudden.
Yeah, can't imagine why. I forgot to mute my phone. I'm sorry, I got excited.
Oh, you're good.
Yeah.
You're good. I would be too. Dad's getting some grub, y'all. Don't worry about it. But
yeah, but I ain't going to be munching, and, you know, because I'm about to get crunch on, man. But hopefully you'll feel the air time appropriately enough for me to get a bite or two in.
Uh-oh. All right.
You know, I'd be starving like Marvin, man.
But, yeah, you know, we will take this time, though, again, to remind everybody to grab something to write with. Again, if you have any questions, we don't want you to forget any questions, so write them down. You may even pick up something from our show tonight or, you know, previous shows, things like that, when you go back and listen. So you might want to write it down. So we just like to remind you about that. Also,
well, you know, go one step further. Write it down. Write it down. Don't think about writing it down because that's when it doesn't get written down, right? You know?
Right.
We got to change people's attitudes about this, man. Write it down. Write it down. Don't trust it to memory. That's how we've been tricked in the first place.
Right. Yeah, that's the whole point. Don't trust it to memory. Write it down. Absolutely.
Hey, man. Absolutely. Sorry, man. I mean to cut in on you like that.
No, you're right.
But again, that's your fault, man. You got me started on this Thursday thing. You got me started on this Saturday thing. I don't even recognize me anymore. I used to be just killing the background, man.
You learning about technology and implementing new things.
Man.
You know, yeah, man. Out there trying new stuff. Yeah. So on Thursdays, ladies and gentlemen, excuse me. So our shows are recorded live every Thursday night. And I say this in case you're listening to our archive shows on the Blog Talk Radio site or our other platforms that we use, such as Apple and Google Podcasts. So you might be listening to a previously recorded show. So Thursday night, 7 p.m. Central Standard Time, our shows are live on Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com, excuse me. And we offer the opportunity for you to engage with us. We have two ways that you can do it. You can either utilize the chat room that's online, and if you just set up a Blog Talk Radio account, which you can set up the free account, it'll give you the choices, and you just choose free. Set up a free account, your card won't get charged, and you can engage with us live in the chat room. Dad loves it, you know. Whereas I think, you know, he likes the chat room, and I like you to dial in. So you have your choice, and you can dial in. Our number here is 516-453-6094. And if you got a pen and paper handy, write that number down now in case you won't forget next week and you want to call in. 516-453-6094. And if you dial in, like I see Adam's in already in the queue there. We'll see your number there. You press 1 on your keypad, and that'll let us know that you want to chime in, you know, ask a question, give us a comment, something like that, something maybe even for us to learn as well. And that will, again, let us know that you want to chime in, you want to come on in and engage with us live. So we enjoy that opportunity for us and for you. So, you know, instead of just sitting back and just listening to us banter back and forth, you know, and I'm glad Dad's muted his phone. In this case, you won't be hearing us eating food or something like that, you know, because we do have lives as well. So so those are just a couple of things, a couple of announcements here. So actually, while Dad is still taking care of a few things, there is something that I did want to talk about before we kind of review last week's show and get into today's topic. So today, you know, and if you all don't know me and how I get excited about these things sometimes, then this is a treat because I love talking about it. And if you know me, then hopefully it's still a treat. You're not like, oh, my God, here we go again. He's getting all in his zen, Rasta mode or whatever you want to call it. But, no, you know, I've been talking a lot how it's really interesting that this year has brought, at least for me, I've noticed so many things in regards to numerology, that there is all these retrogrades and these eclipses that are happening, these new full moons, these new moons. Dad mentioned earlier that he's kind of got the two wolves going on, I think. You know, he's got this internal struggle, and I've been going through some internal struggles, and I'm sure a lot of you have been going through a lot of internal struggles and dealing with the two wolves that occupy our souls and getting through every day, you know, every day, you know, whatever that is. So anyway, today, June 10th. Oh, wait. So June 10th, yeah, it's Gemini season. Happy birthday to Bones, Dr. Jeffrey Akbar. Obona Akbar, happy birthday, cuzzo. A lot of birthdays coming up for our family in June. A lot of Geminis, y'all Geminis. So tonight, June 10th, is a new moon solar eclipse. Tonight's new moon, an energetic Gemini, will pass in front of the sun and create a solar eclipse. Now, this rare occurrence will shake up our life and bring an energetic reset. What it will be bringing is a is supercharged new moon eclipse energy, that they call it, will shift years ahead in life. This cosmic flow for intense healing, growth, forward motion, and transformation will end things out of alignment. But new, better chapters will rapidly start. So it's a transition to the next level of our life, if you will, expecting new, sudden, divine insight on how to manifest greater realities with true love, abundance, wealth, and big breakthroughs. So this new moon solar eclipse, you know, like I said, I love walking outside, looking at the moon. I'm not going to Yeah, I howl at the moon. Well, not really, but I'm kind of keep my wolf story to myself. So this new moon solar eclipse, again, this invitation to exploring new ways of thinking and to remain open to change. To remain open to change our strategy and perspective, a chance to connect with our intuition and our faith, and release the need to understand everything through logic. Now, that's interesting. Release the need to understand everything through logic. This is an opportunity to establish a new mindset and different ways of perceiving our experiences. And we talked a lot about mindsets on this show. We're talking about a growth mindset, not a fixed mindset. So this is establishing a new growth mindset. This expanding your mindset. So that's a new moon solar eclipse. So, Dan, I'm glad that you're taking a moment for yourself there. So I had an opportunity to share this moon moment that we're going through. So I know for me, again, I feel some internal struggles and the battles of the wolves. Dad, I know you're feeling it too a little bit. So maybe that's got something to do with this new moon that's passing through. So you can jump back in whenever you're ready. But
The shifting tides of the universe are always affecting us. The problem is, you know, we don't anchor it in an understandable way. Well, maybe I shouldn't say we. I don't anchor it in an understandable way. I read it like I heard you read it, and I take it in as something factual but not predictable. So it's not like tomorrow I will assess today and the next day I will assess tomorrow, you know, as it aligns with what you just presented. You know, instead, I read it like entertainment, even though I embrace the fact, but not in such a way that I do my own internal research. And you raise some, you raise some very important elements of the cycle of things. You know, not only the cycle of the energy as affected by the Gemini occurrence, but also the life cycles and where they line up. Like you and one of your cousins are about to turn 50. Another one of your cousins has already moved into the era of 50. You know, this is where, you know, dominant or cycle recurrence happens. And the dominant things or the themes of one's life provides portals. And these portals are predictions of time. They're not a singular element of an event in time. So it's like from the past decade, especially for you guys, you know, the opportunities began to reveal itself as a concurring theme. And the question being presented esoterically, again, I love what was that you said about logic. Can you repeat that again, if possible?
Yeah. Give me a sec.
Yeah. Sorry to put you on the spot like that, man. But it was,
no,
you know,
a chance to connect.
If I didn't have one hand full of chicken bone and you know, hold the my notes in the other hand, I would have written down what you said. Well, what was it?
Now I have that visual in my head. Thank you. A chance to connect with our intuition and our faith and release the need to understand everything through logic.
Yeah, and logic is the tendency that most have to understand, right? I love that.
Mm-hmm.
So these life cycles as they occur, and they're not in a random, you know, process, they have intention behind them. You guys moved into that particular cycle of the 40th year, of the 40th decade. And that's where so much what had previously been taken root, moving into that 40th year cycle, 10 years to decide, am I going to deal with this stuff or am I going to let it ride? Not knowing that letting it ride means it will come back during the 50 years cycle. It'll just come back redefined. But it will come back if not dealt with, if not put in some kind of order. That doesn't mean fixed. That doesn't mean broken. That doesn't mean changed. That doesn't mean redefined. It means recognized. Recognized for what it has been and recognize the potential for what it can become. Yeah, we like to hear the things about, you know, going to be prosperous and, you know, all those positive connotations. But the other side of it, see, we get caught up too much in the sun sign, which is really kind of the fun sign. That's the entertainment sign. But it's three levels of astrology when it comes to understanding these cycles that happen. And it's a matter of recognizing not just the date of birth, but there's so many other aspects of one's well-being and life being that is influenced by these cycles and these phenomena that happen in the universe. But again, if we just attuned into it from our sun sign, that is from our date of birth sign, then that tends to be all we look at. We just look at the report and we go, oh, okay. But when we start moving into the esoterics of the meaning behind our birth, then we can understand more deeply how the emotional flow, you know, of karmic occurrence begins to affect our moods, you know, and affect our moods in predictable ways. You know, man, but we're not slaves to that approach. You know, we're kind of action-oriented, so we just like to react to situations before we understand them. And then we deal with whatever we have to deal with after that. But there's so much, man, what the universe has laid out to teach us, you know, and not teach us in a way of anything that has to do with vanity or judgment, just awareness. You know, I think that's the true balance in nature when we can understand awareness, you know, the awareness of the time and not the indifference of the attitudes that come with it. So I love this, man. I love that that my delivery came in time to shut me up.
with some chicken, man. It sounds good.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what's coming up today. Yeah. And again, happy birthday.
Hey.
And all these Geminis out there.
Yeah, man. And your son, my grandson number one, his is Sunday.
Sunday, yeah.
Yeah, and cousin Ray. And
Ray
a host
is
of
coming
others.
Out.
Yeah, yeah.
Your brother.
Others.
Your
yeah.
Brother's
too,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tammy.
Uncle Jeff.
Yeah, Tammy's just
Jeff,
passed.
Tammy.
And
yeah.
Margaret, you remember Margaret, you know, hers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's a few others whose names I won't get into, but, you know, live and well, Gemini as well, you know. And
right on. Right
yeah,
on.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing. Now, Brenda is right on, kind of on the edge, you know, so she thinks of herself as a Cancer, but, you know, she has a lot of Gemini in her. I would love to do her chart. Yeah, I bet she has either an ascendant or a descendant that has something to do with Gemini. I'd bet a dollar to a donut. And you know how I love my donut.
I know how you love your donuts.
Yeah, beautiful thing, man. Beautiful thing to talk about. Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So
last week, it was because we mentioned there was something you mentioned about last week, but it's gone now. But I did start off the show with Carter G. Wilson. I did something a little different instead of the two wolves.
You did it
and
last week
it,
too.
I did it at the end. Yeah, I did it at the end of last week's show. I'm not sure. Adam just chimed in. Well, how much do ratings play into it?
Well,
I'm
let's
sure.
just let's keep going with
what
where we're going right
that.
Now. You know, we can jump into that stuff later on. But right now, you know, we talked about the that CRT thing or whatever it was.
But before that, I was just saying that I started out the show with Carter G. Woodson because last week we were talking about we talked about Black Wall Street and Tulsa. You mentioned Carl Jung, I believe. in controlling the people, to control the people,
yeah,
and control their symbols.
Yeah, to control,
right,
the people's, when you control the people's symbol, you control the people. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what prompted me to read Carter G. Woodson last week, and I wanted to start the show this week because it plays into what we're going to continue from last week. You know, we talked about Tulsa and looking at these issues, these race massacres that occurred before and after Tulsa. Well, that we're going to go into that today, I'm sorry. But we started last week. And some of that, again, has to do with losing our symbols, just as Native Americans have lost their symbols, and we've lost a lot of our symbols. But we're also having to deal with countless of massacres and race riots or race conflict in this lost history of America that's not being taught anymore. So we mentioned CRT, critical race theory, last week. You were about to say something about that.
No, I don't want to get into that right now. I really want to follow the track of this this issue around the energy of race, you know,
yeah,
in riots and massacres and stuff. We can, you know, if time permits tonight, we can pick up on that. But I don't want to shift the flow to that, if you don't mind. I really want to stay focused on at least my part of tonight, which has to do with the history of racial upheaval in this country. The beauty about this country is that it's so young, it's not hard to trace it.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead. I don't, you know, so
yeah, you
can
said
avoid the,
last week you said America is like still an infant, still young.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
you know, still like, look at me, let me get my attention,
yeah,
like an infant would do. Let me act out, let me have these moments.
Yeah.
So earlier in the show, we were just briefly talking about the media, and I was just saying how, you know, it seems like things change. They change things in the media. Things seem a little out of context, as you put it. And in looking at the history, at some of the history of different massacres, like not Ludlow, Slocum, just as an example, Slocum. I know we may not get into Slocum today, but Slocum as an example, how one story, you get one story about things, but then you get the truth. You know, you get the story that that the whites were being kind of like today almost. It's very, very interesting. It was interesting reading these stories about these massacres, how even it's very similar to today, that the whites and Europeans would say one thing, defy the reasoning for their massacres, but in truth, you know, they were the ones that hunted and killed these black mm-hmm. Americans just trying to survive, you know. It was just very interesting, and these stories
yeah.
just, you know, got changed. What were you about to say?
I just wanted to take umbrage issue with you a little bit. I haven't found this to be interesting at all. It's been very debilitating for me. And I guess that's why I really, you know, need to have a little audience and, to just kind of process this. That, you know, this is, maybe it has to do with being my age. Maybe it has to do with so much, you know, being 74 puts me right in the mid 1900s. So very much of what was coming into consciousness for me was so influenced by the late 1800s and early 1900s as far as my immediate ancestors and their struggles for autonomy, their struggles for existence, you know, their struggles for identity played so much into the foundation, my values. It was only 60 years removed from, you know, the Emancipation Proclamation. So everything for me today, you know, is raw dog painful. You know, I wish I had the perspective of you, that I could read it with interest, which would then
spur enthusiasm, you know, and more study. But it's painful, and it just becomes more and more painful. And the reality of the pain is that we don't even know anything about it. You know, we almost read it like entertainment, you know. I'm not saying that's what you did, and I'm not calling it. When I say entertainment, I mean, you know, that, wow, really? You know, just like with The Watchmen, you know, why would it take a TV program to spur so much interest in, you know, the Tulsa Massacre? Because it was, the show was entertainment. And that's what captures our eye, you know, the entertaining quality, you know, of what it is that distracts us from history. You know, I mean, even sports, you know, even the thing that black folks, you know, find a way to carve a way of life out, you know, whether it be the athlete or whether it be the family or whether it be the community, or whether it be the notoriety that continues on, you know, still America has a hard time with the history of black athletics as it relates to what black athletes turn and become agents of and support regardless of its idiocies, like with this guy Kaepernick. How could black athletes, male and female, by and large, the vast majority, whether athletes in the field or in the studio, how could they not come together at such a pivotal time in history and say, no, we're not going to promote the lie anymore? But, you know, instead, it was maybe, what, one or two little things that popped out. And as a result, when it got more and more obvious, things like George Floyd, when it became more and more obvious where you just couldn't sit back and, you know, peek between your fingers, you know, then the history of the linkage of so much in regards to violence toward black people could not be ignored, could not be denied, but still, for the sake of entertainment, let's not spend too much time on it. You know, and I love the fact that, you know, whether it be Slocum or whether it be whatever else we're talking about, that you have found an interest in really getting into it. Man, I hope that carries over to your son. You know, I really do. Because that's, you know, like your mom was a African-American history teacher at Kenwood. So you were surrounded by, you know, most of the books, which she had, I stole, of course, to write Dysfunctional by Design, which I want to talk a little bit about tonight. But you were surrounded by, you know, this context of time in, of the 60s. And I loved it when you read Carter G. Woodson's book, which was written in the 20s, but given so much value, of course it would, because history denied is still history. And once given the opportunity, it catches up with itself. So, of course, his book would be one of the stalwarts that would have been taught in African-American history. For the very quote that you gave, by the way, you know, that was the standard of the book. It was on the back cover, and that quote. You know, so I got a copy of it laying around here somewhere. Probably one I took from your mom. Anyway, you know.
Well, we're not going to say you stole. We're not going to say you stole the books. You just borrowed them, but you just didn't return them.
I have them since it wasn't the library card.
Right.
But she knows I have them. But I still do. So many of them, though, man. I mean, so many. You know, and that's when the Black Renaissance, you know, was driven so much by, more so than not, Black male writers. You know, Black male authors. You know, Black male spearheads of so much of the foundation of civil rights movements. I mean, it's ludicrous to me, and I'm not saying that in a hype for this rap dude. It's ludicrous to me that we don't know who Frederick Douglass was in the same vein that we know who Martin Luther King was. If not for Frederick Douglass, Martin Luther King Jr. never would have happened. And the guy in between, Vernon Johns, you know, and man, But there I go. Let me back up, Will. Let you back in, man. I apologize. You just got me cranked tonight, man.
No, actually, I was kind of segueing for you, kind of giving you the segue. You mentioned dysfunctional by design from the book that you borrowed and didn't return.
Well, no, actually, this is the one I wrote. But I wrote it using those books I borrowed. Yeah, I got you.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Excuse me. But you mentioned it. So what about dysfunctional by design that you wanted to present tonight?
Well, you know, one thing that you just mentioned, and I've only done it with this book. I didn't do it with any other one. There's a bibliography. And thank goodness I did the bibliography in the back of the book, because among other research authors that I use, it also gives a pretty good list of those that, you know, had things out. Not all of them, by the way, I took from your mom. Some of them I actually bought. But looking at the bibliography, you know, it's just stunning what was available, you know, for us. And what made African-American history so valuable, unfortunately, you know, the steam did not lead to the engine really going very far on the tracks, and that's really too bad. It really is. You know, everything seemed to have given way to entertainment. You know, but books like Naeem Akbar wrote Chains and Images of Psychological Slavery, and he also wrote The Community of Self Revised, and Asante wrote Afrocentricity, and Peter Bell wrote Chemical Dependency and the African American. Dr. Lerone Bennett, Before the Mayflower, The History of Black America. Bisson wrote, you know, one of the first accounts of Nat Turner. You know, and there's others too, just a couple more if I may, right quick. Frederick Douglass, of course, The Narrative in the Life of Frederick Douglass, An American Slave. You know, how could that not be required reading for everybody who gets in the news and talks? William Greer and Pierce Cobbs wrote Black Rage, which was one of the first books to take a look at psychology as it impacts on black people from a psychiatric perspective. Of course, when I was in African American history and I saw that book, Black Rage, I thought, oh, cool, it's going to be about black anger. But it was psychology. How disappointed I was. I was all ready to, you know, see the slam bang of things. And your boy, John Henry Clark, isn't that how you pronounce his name? You know, Malcolm
Henrique,
X. The,
something like that.
Henry. Yeah, Henry.
Henry.
Yeah, I knew you
Henrique
would know. That's your boy. Yeah, Henry.
I may not be pronouncing it correctly. Yeah.
You did a lot better than me. You know, Malcolm X, the man in his times, you know. And of course, Dr. Dennis Kimbrough, Think and Grow Rich, A Black Choice. You know, and Thomas and Sillin wrote Racism in Psychiatry. You know, again, two black psychiatrists. I had issues with them because they didn't really give – I didn't feel they gave the proper respect to Greer and Cobbs for Black Rage. They kind of put it down. And then the last one, you know, Bobby Wright, The Psychopathic Racial Personality. You know, The Psychopathic Racial Personality, you know, which I think we touched on in the previous show. And when I was working at the halfway house over on 79th and Essex, the men's residence, one of the residents of the house, man, he was working. We helped him get a job through day labor, and he was working temporarily at a book depository. And, man, he brought me this collection of, we're not supposed to accept gifts and all that, so I didn't take it as a gift. I took it as a contribution to the house, but nobody was interested in it. So when I left, it left with me. And it was The Negro in American History, the Encyclopedia Britannica Educational Corporation came out with these three volumes, 1928 to 71, 1854 to 1927, and 1567 to 1854. Man, you know,
it's like I started realizing through the gradual collection of this information that had been lost, to me anyway, you know, that black folks did more than just slave for a living, man. So when I wrote the book, Dysfunctional by Design, I wrote it for the express purpose of giving some information to the students of my classes who were mostly 98% of them were substance abuse counselors. None of them had certification, and most of them could not afford to go to college, which was the primary way to get what is called continuing education units. You never had to be degreed to be a counselor in Illinois, but you had to be certified. And the way the certification was collecting the necessary hours through continuing education. So the idea came to me when I was working at a college, Monte College up on the north side, it was a two-year Catholic school. The idea came to me that if all people, and I was a certified substance abuse counselor, but if people didn't need a degree, surely there had to be a program that could be created that could help people get continuing education units. So the idea came to me to create one. And that gave birth to the program over there on Oakwood Boulevard at the Center for Inner City Studies. And as that class began to grow, and thank you for the times you would come over and help me out, you know, especially since you didn't ever charge me. people still ask me about you. Still do, you know. It came to me that while the number of students was growing in the classrooms, that we were still using traditional books to help them deal with the primary client population of Chicago, which were people of color, mostly black, Hispanic, for sure, you know, male and female. And we had an increase of HIV-related clients as well during that stretch. So they were anything but the atypical, you know, white European middle-class Protestant gamma-type alcoholic, which was the whole basis of what treatment was formulated on. So the question was, well, how do we treat these clients that research has never allowed us the method to do? So these books that had come to me through working at the halfway house, through working at the college, and it was cool when I worked at the college because I was the director of the Black American Addictions Program, which it was a college-based program, so you got credits, you know, going to these classes. But so being the director of the Black American Addictions Program, I would send notices out to different bookstores and colleges and whatever, you know, announcing our program just for the sake of marketing. And man, all of these books, they started sending me these books because they wanted us to put their books in our library, which was non-existent, you know, but they didn't know that. So I'm getting all these books on black issues in treatment and black methods of care and black history and black. Man, and it's like, so I packaged all this stuff and took it with me when our program ended, you know, which again, thank you for being the DJ for the graduation class. Me and you showed up in Texas, didn't we? Anyway, you probably don't remember that.
I don't remember being in Texas.
Well, I wore a tux. I thought you did too. You must have wore a black suit. Father George Clements was the keynote speaker, and Reverend Helen Carey did the benediction, you know, from Christ Universal Temple, where we had the graduation ceremony. So it was, you know, truly something special that gave me the incentive to create this continuing education training program. But we still had pretty much the traditional books, even the black books were traditional in their psychological approaches. So I had the idea from the classroom to create a book that was meant to just be used in the class, just to give us something to operate from in dealing with black clients. And, you know, the title came to me while talking with my buddy Reggie Winston. And I'm just talking with him. It was something that was being bantered about. And I said, yeah, man, it's almost like, you know, we've just been raised to be dysfunctional by design. And I thought, you know, blame Will. That's the title. And so, you know, it was a matter of, and I knew nothing about, you know, knew nothing about how to go about this stuff. There was no internet, you know, so there was no Google. So, you know, there was no email. There was no none of that. You know, everything had to be done through snail mail and research and buying books off the shelf at Crock and Britannos, which Emma, you know, accompanied me many times through that bookstore, and also is why I borrowed books from her that she used in the classroom. And it gave birth to this thing that I didn't want to just approach as looking at the issues of substance abuse, but I wanted to bring a historical context into play, you know, for the very reason that you said earlier about Dr. Carl Jung and the control of people, you control their symbol. You know, if there's no research that had been done on black clients, if there's no methods of care outlined, if there's no documents that promote any idea of a different need for a different type of client coming into the traditional setting, how then can we create a meaningful and effective treatment plan or plan of action to help them, you know, when they're recycled back into whatever their existence was that brought them to treatment in the first place, you know, which in itself made clear that we're dealing with some folks who got some completely different issues, you know, in so many ways, and coming into treatment later in life so often. So anyway, that gave birth to this idea, published in 1995. But I tell you, man, I dug it out. I mentioned it last week. You may not remember, but I didn't have it. I hadn't dug it out yet, so I didn't have it in front of me, so I really couldn't speak from it. But I started to search and found it, and as I started reading something I wrote, I'm looking at it as it relates to today, and I'm thinking, man, this is depressing. Well, not really depressing. Eye-opening, but frustrating. You know, but before that, there was a quote from this other book I found called The Way of the Wizard. Again, because my son had to bring it up. You know, and even when you were talking about celestial shifting, you know, there's this beautiful quote from Rumi in the book, The Way of the Wizard, and it says, "You are the unconditional spirit trapped in conditions, like the sun in eclipse." Read that one more time. You are the unconditional spirit, the unconditioned spirit. I'm sorry. You are the unconditioned spirit trapped in conditions like the sun in eclipse. So all of this just starting to manifest inside of this little feeble brain of mine, and it's like all these connecting the dots are bringing these issues to light, and so many themes that are not new, that are aged through history that we've been denied, but it's in a country that is so young in its own history that it doesn't take a whole lot of research. You know, it's not like going down into the catacombs of wherever it was that Gandalf had to go to find out who Gollum was. You know, it's like, no, it's right here in front of him. So I just wanted to just go into a little bit of it tonight, if I can, man. Dysfunctional by Design, just the first few pages. And then to bleed off into the theme of the issues revolving around the awakening in time regarding all of this race upheaval, what they call it, riots, massacres, whatever. So is that okay?
Yeah.
You cool with
that? Yeah, I'm cool. Yeah.
It starts out, "I was not raised to hate and believe through much of my adolescence that nobody was. That belief was changed in one brief moment
when my eighth grade social studies teacher showed my classmates and me a picture of a dead black body in a magazine. Three blood-oozing letters had been carved into the belly of the body, KKK, and my little world of innocence came crashing down all around me. I did not sleep well that night. Although most modern psychologists offer that there is no research to indicate that African Americans function any differently psychologically than others, make no mistake, racism has taken its toll on the psyche of Americans of African descent. Moreover, it would seem virtually impossible for anyone living under the guise of minority to become self-actualized inherently. The ceiling created by the consciousness of a minority status is a condition imposed upon the culturally diverse that prohibits self-determination. The value system of minority consciousness is governed, defined, and rewarded in accordance to the customs of the white male, middle-class Protestant American of today. This valued system is influenced by the Eurocentric government of the past, the legacy builders who laid the foundation for the early American way of life. That's those who we call the founding fathers. Yeah, well, this is what they gave birth to. So anyway, the black experience in America is a continuum of change that cannot be anchored to any one particular event in time. However, the issues written here regarding the reclaiming of cultural identity will focus on the history of the descendants of the Africans brought to America in 1619 as indentured servants, using the historic birth of the first black child born in American soil in 1624 as the symbolic birth of a complex, diverse culture of color that defines the traditional analysis of cultural anthropology. Man, I love that. Anyway, to seek an understanding of the cruel and unjust treatment imposed upon them by the oppressive and racist environment of the past, Americans of African descent have had to depend on the educational resources developed from the same system that created the problem. That's as dysfunctional as treating depression with alcohol. Alcohol is classified as a depressant drug. The Africans brought in bondage to America were a mixture of at least four great races, the Bantus, the Fulatas, the Galas, and the Negritans, and were representative of many different tribes, the Basutas, the Ifik, the Fulas, the Igbos, the Ebonyi, Mandingos, only to name a few. The descendants of these rich cultures should be honored and valued as a precious link to a forgotten history. Yet, from their inception, Americans of African descent have been continuously misrepresented in most social studies, called by many degrading names, and labeled every defamation imaginable. Slavery has so effectively removed the cultural patterns of African heritage that to this day the cultural, economic, political, and spiritual potential of African Americans has not been actualized. And that's just the beginning. So it's taken into context the idea that if this is the foundation of the psyche of black Americans that wind up in treatment, what then are we dealing with historically? You know, and how then do we approach realistically what needs to be developed within this forgotten class to help them become effective contributing members of a society that has invisibilized them all their lives? You know, so if I may continue a little bit more, or have I put you to sleep yet?
I'm cheating a little bit. I may not have the advantage of some of our listeners, and I'm following along in the book. So I'm just looking at my notes.
I didn't even know you
also
had a copy of it, man.
I got a copy of all your books.
Yeah, my man. Cool. Okay. So
Excuse me, sorry. First of all, let me ask you, just as a writer, reading out of the book that you published, and you've used this reference before, but it seems like I'm just curious, like, how does that feel? Like being, you know, because there was one point you're like, man, I love that. So
yeah.
So, you know, do you still find joy in reading, you know, reading your books? Or is it just depending on the relevance of the situation?
I find joy, I find validation, I find satisfaction, and I find disappointment.
Wow.
And some other superlatives as well. But for me, the true joy is the fact that I can say I wrote it, regardless, you know, and it's kind of trippy, man. You know, I mean, because we're talking about a book published in 95. So it took about 5 years, three years. I got it done real quick, amazingly fast, especially without the benefit of the internet. So in fast forwarding and reading from it today, of course, I'm just reading certain excerpts and not, you know, dealing with the overall aspect of everything that it covers. But in just what I'm reading, it's like, man, you know, this is history. You know, this is history. And I feel kind of, how can I put it without sounding too grandiose? I feel honored, man. I feel honored that this dude that took 5.5 years plus summer school to graduate from high school does not have a formal college education, has been married and divorced twice, that became himself a drug-abusing alcoholic, you know, actually contributed something like this, you know. And this is in the Library of Congress, and it does have its own ISBN number. I feel kind of, man, I feel blessed, you know, by the Lord that, you know, that this would have, you know, been, boy, now I really sound corny, that this would have been delivered unto me. Yeah, man. Yeah, so, you know, it's,
you said,
it's
a, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go on.
No, there was a couple of different notes I had here, and I just wanted to go back. I know you wanted to continue, but I just wanted to read this part again. The Americans of African descent have had to depend on the educational resources developed from the same system that created the problem.
Yeah.
That's as dysfunctional as treating depression with alcohol.
Yeah.
It's like, wow. Depending on the same educational resources developed from the same system that created the problem.
Yeah.
And it's history, and we're still living it right now, actually.
Yeah.
Caught up in it.
Yeah. And understanding more and more what the debilitating aspects of the history denied does to an entire people. See, we may have been denied, we have maybe been denied our history, but so has the rest of America. So it's operating from its own dysfunctional perspective as much as we are. You know, white America really believes its history is accurate. And that's why white America has such a hard time accepting the history they was never taught. Instead, they react to it. You know, they really do believe that they have earned the right to dictate to the rest of Americans in this democratic society whatever their benefits will be. And white America really takes the stance that whatever I get, it's because they have been willing to give it up. Well, maybe not always willing. Matter of fact, never willing. Always forced to give it up. And therefore, I've always had an attitude as if it was their inherent right to keep me a member of the American society. I was born and raised here. I am, maybe I'm not a patriot, but I am a black patriot, you know, and I am as American as cherry pie, you know. I am, in fact, more indigenous to American society, as we know it to be, than Native Americans to the Native society that's been destroyed. You know, I'm not a migrant. I didn't migrate down from the northern plains of Alaska through Canada. I'm homegrown, and I'm treated like a migrant.
like an immigrant. You know, I mean, this is my home. This is the home of my immediate ancestors. Yeah, we got links to other bloods, and there's probably, you're not going to find too many Americans of African descent who are 100% Mandingo warriors. You know, this is, you know, we're born from the degradation and rape and desolation of black females and their black male counterparts. But this is what, where I was created, right here. We don't exist nowhere else but here. We are as American as Mexicans are Mexican. But you wouldn't think it. You wouldn't think it. You know, as a matter of fact, the Europeans that came here are less American than I am. You know, but you wouldn't think it based on what history tells you. So I'm sorry. I kind of went off script there, man.
No, no. I just wanted to point that out. Again, just looking at my notes from the book, and I just wanted to reiterate, you know, depending on the same resource that's caused the problem in the first place, and this problem still exists.
Still,
you know, looking at history,
still exists,
and looking at where we are, there's really not a lot of differences except for maybe the year. You know,
that's it. That's it.
Well,
go ahead.
And that's why, you know, I may have misspoken and used the wrong word of interesting, but it is interesting only because...
No, you didn't misspeak. You didn't misspeak. That's a beautiful thing that you find interest in this. You know how many don't? How many don't want to be bothered? If you don't, you know, I'm talking about black folks. I ain't talking about white folks. I understand why they don't, you know, because it's gonna offend their sensibilities and stir up some degree of wrathful guilt, you know, and I'm tired of dealing with wrathful guilt from, you know, from the people in control. We're dealing with wrathful guilt right now. But go ahead.
I mean, when we're talking about hundreds of, you know, 100 years of racial issues.
Yeah.
I mentioned Slocum, you know, where they're like, well, the story was this, you know, this black guy, he was, you know, this guy, he was being real hard on this handicapped white guy, you know. That was the story. But no, it was the white guy tripping on the brother, you know. And how many times do we still have to deal with that kind of story to this day? How many times, as we say, how many times does the victim have to justify being killed?
Yeah,
you know?
I love it when you said that the first time, man. It stuck with me like my ribs to my side, man. You know, like, yeah, man. Yeah, say
but
that
even,
again,
you know,
man. Say that again.
How often does the victim have to justify being killed?
I hope people are hearing that, man. You know, man. You know, go ahead, bro.
So that was just, you know, 100 years from Tulsa or 100 years from Slocum or 100 plus years from Springfield, and the list goes on and on.
And the list goes on and on,
You know, it's like the story just continues. But I didn't want to take you off stride from Dysfunction by Design, you know, because there's a bunch of quotes in here, and I can just spit some more out. But I want you to finish your flow on the point you were getting at.
Yeah, but you're not taking me off stride, man. This is where you brought me. You know, this is, you know, when we started, I knew I was in trouble. I was kind of okay. I was kind of cool until we hit Manifest Destiny. I ain't been right since. You know, I mean, something that is not taught at all in classroom is the whole point of why we are deficient in history today, you know. And,
I'm going to disagree with you. I think the starting point was growth mindset, but really emotional intelligence. I think that was really the kick that you didn't know was the kick. And it was, I don't know, you just seemed so fascinated with these discussions in our early shows And then we were able to apply some of these concepts and ideas of, you know, mindsets and emotional intelligence and observations and things like that. And then leading up to Manifest Destiny.
So you're saying that's what opened my nose, huh? All right.
That's my own opinion.
Yeah, I agree. Why wouldn't I agree? Heck yeah, I agree, man. Right on, bro. Way to grab
That's just my opinion. I kind of pulled way out there a little bit, but, you know, I like playing left field.
I like that. That fits very well. You know, that fits very well. You know, that's what opened my nose to this thing. Yeah, man. The ground got to be cultivated before anything can grow. You know, so right on, man. Yeah, that's right. Keep me historically accurate.
You're the last historian, man. We're with you on that one.
Amen, bro. Amen. So just jumping back and jumping forward, and if, in fact, you are following with your copy, I'm going to page 13, the next to last paragraph. There are stories of those of African ancestry who fought for the freedom of slaves even before the 19th century. Olanda Equiano, later known as Gustavus Bassa, was the son of an Igbo tribal elder. Kidnapped from Guinea in 1756, he managed to eventually buy his freedom from a Quaker merchant, and he fought for the emancipation of other Africans until his death in 1801. So now we're edging into the 19th century. There were the revolutionaries, and I'm using the word revolutionaries. There were the revolutionaries who fought for the liberation of slaves during the 19th century, who often paid dearly with their lives. And I just wanted to touch upon a few, most of whom I'm assuming most have never heard about. One, of course, we have. The first is Gabriel Prosser, a Virginia slave of no ordinary status. He believed that it was his God-intended calling to deliver his people from bondage. I would imagine not too unlike Moses. Unfortunately, he didn't have, he didn't have Cecil B. DeMille to do his movie, which was full of lies. But I still watch it.
Right. Right.
For entertainment, you know. I got my morning prayer circle to deal with the accuracy of Bible, you know, but I got the Ten Commandments to keep, you know, to keep the thrill of the entertainment alive. Yeah, what were you going to say? I'm sorry. Will.
No, I was saying asterisk for entertainment purposes only.
Yeah. Okay. In 1800, with the help of his wife and brothers, Prosser recruited thousands of slaves from the surrounding counties of the Richmond area. That's Richmond, Virginia. Many served in the Revolutionary War and therefore had some knowledge of military tactics. Gabriel spent many months planning to invade Richmond to kill all of the whites except the French and the Quakers. Some may ask why, but hopefully we know why, and establish a black government with him at the head. However, on the night of the raid, a powerful storm made progress toward the city impossible, and the rebellion was stalled. Prosser learned later that he had been betrayed by two of his own, and that the city had been laying in wait. The next day, martial law was declared, and many Negroes were hastily and indiscriminately arrested. A $300 bounty was placed on Prosser's head. Again betrayed, Gabriel Prosser was caught. He was hanged along with 15 others on October 7, 1800, before a wildly cheering mob. But the fuse was lit. Denmark Vesey, a slave carpenter who purchased his freedom in 1800 by winning a lottery. He was the student of the Bible and often taught slaves about how the children of Israel were delivered out of Egypt. He tried to convince others through the use of scripture the wrongs of slavery. In 1822, Vesey and a group of Charleston house servants and slaves that he had recruited attempted an armed attack on the city. But he, too, was betrayed, captured, and executed. David Walker was born in 1785, the son of a slave father and free mother. He lived as a free man in Boston. In 1829, Walker published a pamphlet, Walker's Appeal, in four articles. Among the many passages in his pamphlet, Walker wrote, "Kill or be killed. Look upon your wife and children and mother and answer God Almighty and believe this, that it is no more harm to kill a person who is trying to kill you than to take a drink of water when you are thirsty." Walker's appeal struck a chord of fear, I wonder why, throughout the slave states in the South. And the more abolitionists pushed the theme of kill or be killed to the South, the more the slave states trembled at the fear of a slave revolt. Walker was a man driven by his passion, and he attacked the Christian hypocrisy of slavery with much enthusiasm. In the spring of 1830, with little or no regard for his safety, Walker traveled to Richmond, Virginia, to distribute his pamphlet. The Virginia authorities rounded up as many of Walker's pamphlets as they could find, and Walker was arrested. Shortly after his release, Walker discovered that a bounty was placed on his head. In June 1830, David Walker's body was found in his shop, only one short year after his pamphlet was published. Some suspected that he had been poisoned by the Friends of the Slavery from up north. And then that comes to the one that probably everyone is most familiar with, Nat Turner. Prophet Nat, as he was known throughout the Black South, was born in slavery in Southampton County, Virginia, in 1800. There are some written reports that indicate that his mother tried to kill him at birth so that he should not live the life of a slave. In 1831, Turner led an army of at least 60 slaves and freedmen in the most famous and probably the most bloodiest uprising against slavery, which alone would have changed the whole nation's attitude regarding the demeanor of those held in bondage. That, right there, probably had a lot to do, I believe, with where the distortion of history began as well. We can't let this story get out, that these crazy Negroes actually don't have any problem revolting against us good old white owners. You know, I really do believe that. Like Prosser, Turner thought of himself as a mystic. His mother, father, and grandmother instilled in him at an early age. I bet his mama did, especially after she failed to kill him. Anyway, I'm sorry. His grandmother and his mother, father, and grandmother instilled in him at an early age that he was intended for some great purpose. In his well-known Confessions, as recorded by Thomas Gray, Turner revealed many religious visions that he had experienced prior to his armed revolt. You know, Harriet Tubman had a lot of visions as well. You know, and, you know, how important do you think it would have been, Will, if the connection of God and freedom from bondage and leadership from black people who felt so in tune with God that they felt God spoke to them would have had on the impact of our own religious upheaval or belief system?
No, that contradicts manifest destiny.
Completely See, man.
Contradicts.
Oh, my man. See, that's why I love doing this show with you, man. I mean, I apologize for getting so mad at you earlier, man. I look forward to it. Anyway, the brunt of, am I here yet? Let's see. Unlike Prosser and Vesey, Turner was very careful about who he shared his intentions with. Nat began his onslaught with only 7 carefully chosen comrades. He was sure that as his rebellion progressed, more and more slaves would join the battle, and to a degree, he was correct. This was the same strategy that John Brown believed in, by the way. But let me just keep going. The brunt of Turner's revolution only lasted 2 days. Although defeated, Turner was not captured until 2 months later. The legacy of Nat Turner was one of both glory and terror, whereas the slaveholding states of the South viewed him as a bloodthirsty ghoul. Those stolen from their native land, bred to do the burden of beasts, and to whom even the smallest degree of human dignity was not allowed, viewed him as a hero. On November 11, 1831, Nat Turner was hanged. There is no record of where or if his body was buried. One account stated that his corpse was skinned and that his flesh was used for grease. And on it goes, right? Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., we could add Fred Hampton to the list, and so many other black heroes. And Dr. Huey P. Newton died in a hail of gunfire. Many other black heroes, and many
stories of bravery. Yet those of my generation, were not taught any of it, or about the many explorers, inventors, or pioneers of African descent. You know, and I just want to jump to this. There's a lot of this I'm not going to read, but I do want to add this one. Mary Ellen Mammy Pleasant was born a slave. A wealthy farmer purchased her freedom for $600 and sent her to Boston to be educated. She married a free man, and when he died, she received an inheritance of $50,000. $50,000. Upon settling in San Francisco in 1849, Mammy Pleasant amassed a sizable fortune. In 1858, she traveled to Canada to personally deliver $300,000 to a man named John Brown. You know, again, the dots connect and the links speak to a desperation for freedom that history has denied us. I want to read one last story, man. I'm sorry. I know we're really cutting into time here. And this is 8 years after. Well, let me start here. Allen Allensworth was born a slave in 1842. At age 12, Allen was separated from his family, sold for daring to learn to read and write. He was separated from his family because he learned how to read and write. In 1863, and still a slave, Allen managed to become an Army nurse in the Union Army. 8 years later, Allen Allensworth was ordained a minister, and in 1886, he was appointed chaplain of the 14th Infantry by President Cleveland. Allensworth was, at that time, the only black chaplain in the U.S. Army. When Allensworth retired from the Army in 1906 with the rank of lieutenant colonel, he was the highest-ranking black military officer. At age 64, he decided to fulfill a lifelong dream. This is a dream. In 1908, along with an associate, Allensworth purchased 2,700 acres of land in Salido, California, and renamed it Allensworth. Under Allensworth's leadership, in three years, the town that bore his name grew to 300 families, and then, I'm sorry, let me do this. In 3 years, the town that bore his name grew to 300 families. Then in 1911, trouble began. See, these dates, man, they all link up. You know, they may not link up right there in the same place and time, but they link up as far as the flow of this riotous reaction that people started having to these people who were only professing their God-given right to be free. First, the Pacific Farming Company took control of the town's water, took control of the town's water rights. But the town eventually regained control of the water rights through the courts. Next, the Santa Fe Railroad built a station in a nearby white community that diverted much of Allensworth's business. Although Allensworth, the town, continued to survive, Allensworth, the man, was killed by a motorcyclist at age 72. Over the next 30 years, people gradually moved out of Allensworth because of a decreasing water supply. When high levels of arsenic were discovered in the town's drinking water in 1966, people moved out permanently. So we get into these themes of social upheaval as reflective of the many dates of these massacres. There's some things that reveal itself again, and that's really why I wanted to talk primarily about the Ludlow Massacre in 1914. Began as a Colorado coal strike in September 1913 and culminated into the Ludlow Massacre of April 1914. 11,000 miners in southern Colorado worked for the Colorado Fuel and Iron Corporation, which was owned by the Rockefeller family. You know, aroused by the murder of one of their organizers, they went on strike against low pay, dangerous conditions, and feudal domination of their lives in towns completely controlled by the mining companies. So they might as well have been slaves. You know, they would pay the paltry salary, but they had no control over, how their money was spent. Anyway, the Ludlow Massacre was a mass killing perpetuated by an anti-striker militia, you know, an anti-striker militia during the strike. Soldiers from the Colorado National Guard and private guards employed by the Colorado Company, the CFNR, attacked a tent colony that housed roughly 1,200 strikers and their families. Approximately 21 people, including minors, wives, and children, were killed. John D. Rockefeller, Jr., a part owner of CFNI, was widely excoriated. I don't know what excoriated means, but I have a feeling it wasn't too good. He was widely excoriated for having orchestrated the massacre. This is John D. Rockefeller, Jr., man. In retaliation for the massacre at Ludlow, bands of armed miners attacked dozens of anti-union establishments, destroying property, engaging in several skirmishes with the Colorado National Guard along a 225-mile front from Trinidad to Louisville. So I'm assuming Trinidad must be a place in Kentucky. I don't know. From the strikes beginning in September 1913 to the intervention of federal troops under President Woodrow Wilson's orders on April 29, 1914, an estimated 69 to 200 people were killed, and it was dubbed at the time the deadliest strike in the history of the United States, and the story goes on. But I just wanted to tie again, you know, a pivotal historical issue that once we start really getting into the different, I think it was at least 23 or 24 of them, once we start getting into the real themes behind these massacres of black people and people of color, we'll find this theme, this recurring theme, has never lost its flavor, has never lost its flair, has never lost its intention. You know, I believe starting with the Indian Wars, you know, that took 200 years. You know, we're looking at, you know, from the late 1800s to now, you know, what, maybe 250 years of the same themes. But the difference being that we have the internet. Now, the difference being that white America ain't trying to take our land. You know, white America is trying to keep us from having equal rights. But if we don't have anything that they're trying to take from us for their own gain, they're just trying to keep us from having their own gain. And, you know, there were some other things I wanted to get into, but I can't believe it's as late as it is. So I wanted to get into the history of the Electoral College so we could understand, which is a show we did, you know, a couple shows actually, which we did because we got into it right before the election, you know, and also the impact of John Brown's, I think I got into that John Brown thing because it was a special on HBO at Showtime. And but as I got more and more into the history of what that show was saying about him and your boy, I think Ethan Hawke did a great job. Still, there were elements of it that did not connect the dots with black history in the way I felt it should, especially with Mammy Pleasance giving this dude $300,000 to fuel his rebellion. Her name was not mentioned in the show at all. I know it wasn't because I would have remembered because I wrote about it. And also how the different presidents lined up, you know, at these stretches in time, which is what we covered in the show. I also wanted to talk a little bit about tying into it institutional racism or what they call systemic racism today and how it was engineered, especially through the educational system, so that, of course, if we're only taught a history controlled by those who write it, you know, until lions have historians, hunters will always be heroes. So, of course, white America is always the hero of everything that it has ever involved itself with. And I came across something, and I'm going to shut up, man. I'm going to get out the way. And thank you for your patience in letting me do all this, Will. I don't even know what it's connected to. I don't know if it just fell out from something else, but I read it and I thought, damn, you know, everything that America contends with is an ongoing reaction to their collective mindset. So, yes, what's understood does not need to be explained. However, understanding does. And this is why identifying one's opinion is so important in a place like the United States of America. So there's mindset again, man. Uh-oh. Did I lose you?
No, I'm here. I thought you had more.
Oh, no, I'm stopping. That's why I said I'm stopping right there, man, because I didn't realize it was so late, man. Well, man, thank you for your patience and letting me go on and on. Oh, there was more. But it would go all the way to the 9 o'clock hour, man, so I'm not going to do that. You know, thank you for being so generous with your time tonight.
So, Ludlow, who was the president at that time?
Woodrow Wilson. That's what I said. He was the one who ordered the on April 29th, he ordered the National Guard or federal troops, which was the National Guard, to quell the strike. The strikers, rather, rebellion. And that's when 200 people were killed. And it led to some changes, you know, because the miners still had a union. And unions, you know, again, you know, unions were very powerful, you know, elements in middle-class America. You know, and it's why unions are so severely under attack today, undermines the intent of the power grabbers. You know, so there were other things that came from it as a result of this massacre, but it didn't affect Wilson. You know, remember what we talked about in an earlier show. Woodrow Wilson fell in love with Birth of a Nation. He thought it was the greatest movie he ever saw. Woodrow Wilson
right.
had absolutely no love for black people. None.
Yeah. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah. Your fault.
And so,
your fault.
What, I forgot or that you're just bringing it up?
Yeah, that I'm bringing this stuff up. It's your fault, man. Hey.
Yeah, well.
I was nice and calm in my life before you came along with this radio stuff.
Well, no, yeah, way before then. Right, yeah.
My
of course,
man.
You'd be in the background when I was still doing my shows, and you would still be raising, pumping your fist up in the air, you know.
Yeah, well, that's because you were working with a guy who was holding you back, man. He was scared of you, man. He was scared of you. He was scared of your popularity. He was scared of your genius.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, this is another rabbit hole. It's kind of like, it's just another rabbit hole. I'll just say that. Again, in looking at the American history, the history of violence.
Mm-hmm.
So again, what did I say last week? The denial of hate, the hate of denial of American history.
Yes, you did.
Even in the 1800s, full of just attack after attack after attack. You know,
man, we're getting the hate of denial right now in the courts and the vote. You know, we don't even need to turn to the aspects of violence. You know, to see the hate of denial as it's reflecting itself once again in the courts, you know, to go against the very fiber of what all this stuff was about to begin with, the right to vote. Man, it's amazing. But without that historical perspective, we treat it like current events. I'm sorry, Will. Go ahead. Man.
No, I'm looking at a list of different events that happened in the 1800s. And it's just,
oh, yeah. Got the list right in front of me.
One after another, you know. 1874, 18, two of them. 1875, 1876. You know, I mean, and it's not just black Americans, you know. The Chinese workers, the Wounded Knee Massacre, December 29th, 1890. You know, we were talking about the connection with the Indian Removal Act.
And the Wounded Knee Massacre is considered to be the end of the Indian Wars, by the way.
December 29th, 1890. Wow.
That's considered to be the end of the Indian Wars.
symbolically.
Oh, it's a lot. It's a lot.
Well, it's only a lot because it hasn't. See, it wouldn't be a lot if it had been the history of America as taught continuously from the inception of America. It's been a lie, and everything about it has perpetrated the lie, has perpetuated the lie, I'm sorry. You know, starting with, you know, the whatever the philosophy and whatever the intention of what is called the, I hate the term, but the founding fathers, you know. Those founding fathers gave birth to people of color as a result of the rape of the slaves that they, female slaves they owned. You know, but anyway, whatever their agendas were, whatever their, you know, like one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence was Dr. Benjamin Rush, Rush Presbyterian Hospital right there in Chicago. Dr. Benjamin Rush, in his early teaching of psychiatry, he's considered to be the father of American psychiatry. He said in his early teachings that, you know, that Negroes suffered from what he considered to be a disease similar to leprosy. He called it negritude. And he said the only cure for it would be close association with white people. Now, I don't know if he meant that they had to turn white or if they had to be white, but he said suffering from negritude was going to be their undoing unless they became white. You know, so this was the doctor of American psych. I'm sure maybe over time he began to change some of his teachings, maybe so, but it doesn't matter. What was the impact of those he initially taught who ran out and started teaching the same stuff? You know, they didn't come back and apologize. You know, I mean, like, this, man, this has been wearing me out, man. But it's wearing me out in a good way because it's given understanding in a way that I never had understanding before. There is an intention behind a subdued or otherwise distorted history. You know, it's no different than the distortion of history that Germany dealt with the rise of Nazism. You know, and I'm sure that if we went through history, conquering, you know, the conquering nations all around the world did the same thing. You know, it gave people its own version of history, you know, as a means of conquering the people and justifying it in the eyes of whatever their divine presence was, you know, or belief was, you know. So, it, you know, it, but this is America right now, and this country is much too young, in my mind anyway, to be causing the devastation that is caused. My God, man, it dropped an atom bomb on human beings just to win a war. And it's just come and gone in history that we only get certain reminders of now around December 7th. And then it ain't about dropping the bomb. Then it's about justifying it through the movies of, you know, Pearl Harbor or 30 Seconds Over Tokyo or, you know, all of these others, again, that, you know, give so much glory to this country. It's a frightening endeavor indeed. Now, you know, I watched this series, Band of Brothers, and there's one part of it that I can't, one segment of it where they were actually interviewing one of the guys who was from World War II, and he said, you got to remember that what makes this a particular type of war from an American perspective is that this country was attacked. You know, that had to be something brand new for America to have to deal with. it got a reverse. I mean, he didn't say that. That was, you know, my editorial comment behind it. I can understand America, white America being so up in arms, but that's because they weren't used to being attacked. They were used to being the attacker. You know, somebody might argue, yeah, but, you know, like black folks lined up to join. Well, we're black patriots. This is the only, we were defending the only country we know. We don't know ourselves anywhere else. You know, if you raise
you mentioned
a child.
That, in the, you mentioned that in the book. I'm sorry.
No, it's 'cause if you raise a child in a dysfunctional home, that child is going to go out and hook up with somebody that reminds them of that dysfunctional home, because for them, that's normal. They don't have nothing else to compare it to. If they're raised in an environment that is incestuous or violent or otherwise abusive, they're going to latch on to somebody who is violent and abusive or incestuous because they don't know to feel any other way. They may intellectually say they don't want to, like I don't know how many clients I had, you know, in this particular example, female clients that said, I swore up and down I would never marry somebody like my father. And here I am having the same complaints about my husband. Yeah. I tell you what, if black client counselors want to learn anything about black clients, yeah, make it a point to interview as many black clients as you can. But understand, don't go into that conference with anything to say, because they'll tell you real quick, oh, wait a minute, man, we're not here to get your opinion. You're here to get ours. We'll tell you when you can talk. And I've had more than one family tell me that. Hey, man, we're not interested in whose side you are. You just need to shut up and take notes. I'm sorry, Will. Go ahead, man. I promise I'm not saying nothing else.
I wonder
not
if
the show's over.
I wonder if things would have been different if America didn't take Hawaii in the first place.
Now, how about that? Yeah, let's not forget about that. Hawaii wasn't American, it was Hawaiian.
It was Hawaii, right, that was it. It wasn't even part of the United States of America. They were doing their own thing.
Doing their own thing.
Like we're gonna include you now in our union here. You know, we're going to take over your assets and stuff and take over your land.
Yeah.
And park our ships over here so we can have, you know, better military strategic movements.
There you
and
go,
things
man.
Like that.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, Japan's like, oh, man, they right there. Let's just go ahead and just get them there. You know, but I wonder what would have happened if that didn't even occur in the first place. You know, they're mad. You know, it's unfortunate, of course, that it happened. But it's like, I don't know. You know, I think back again to this analogy of America being this infant and us being these kids, and we're on this playground, you know, white, black, red, brown, you know, red, brown, yellow, all these different nationalities, you know, as one, you know, one group, you know, but they hold all the sand, you know, and
yeah.
they don't. You know, they're very selective on who gets to play in the sand. You know, you can play for a little while, but, you know, no, don't get too happy with it. You know, yeah, you can have some of this over here, but you're going to have to give me something else. You know, and then get upset when they don't get their way. It was very interesting when you said that yesterday. Last week's show. And I actually listened to last week's show. I was very proud of myself this week for actually doing something I said I was going to do. So that was actually really cool. But even if we look at these massacres, I mean, they're going all the way back to, what,
1863.
You know, but I think you raised a good point again last week. Shouldn't we really look at slavery itself as a massacre?
Yeah, man. Yeah. Yeah, these dates are just like, you know, pegs in the sand, man, just marking the territory. But slavery is a continuum holocaust, you know, that from its inception, that was its intention. So that's a whole massacre, a minimum of 500 years, but, you know, America can't handle that kind of math.
So, you know, ladies and gentlemen, I know that some of this context may to some be a little dark, but this is the history of America. This is our history. This is what we have gone through, and this is kind of where we are today. But these are the lessons that we don't talk about. These are the lessons that aren't being taught in our classrooms. This isn't the lessons to kind of give us an idea why we're here where we are today instead of scratching our heads and like, how the heck did that happen?
How did that happen?
Oh, yeah. It's been happening. And like a kid, if they keep getting away with it, they're going to keep doing it. You know,
just like a kid.
That's why I really like this analogy of the infant. But yeah, how do we get here? You know, but we've been here. But without proper knowledge of history and connecting the dots, it's hard to see that.
Yeah.
You know, so
it's not impossible to.
Yeah.
Amen, man.
So, you know, ladies and gentlemen, this will be part of a continuing discussion. We've got Juneteenth coming up. Like I said, Slocum, we mentioned Slocum. I keep pronouncing it wrong.
Yeah.
But that's the end of July. I keep thinking that was June. But that's the end of July, July 29th to the 30th. But we have all these events that we think is important, you know, and understanding our history and, again, looking at what we've had to deal with and where we are today.
Yeah, man. Well, I see that your cousin Ray joined the forum, man, and I think my girl, too. Sue. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Susan.
Right on.
I know you want to say yada yada because that's a
I'm sticking with, nope.
And since you mentioned you know, Ray and Adam and Sue and everybody in the chat
mm-hmm.
room, and thank you all for listening. Those that were listening tonight, period. Thank you. Adam had a couple of questions. I did want to just touch on one. He was saying you post a lot of quotes on Facebook. But Dad has a lot of quotes and a lot of poems that he puts on Facebook all the time. So, you know, look for his books, and maybe we can republish some of his books. Off Place and Land, Dysfunctional by Design, Mastering the Art of Failure in Relationships. Definitely check him out Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. on Blog Talk Radio, 10 a.m. That's blogtalkradio.com/greenbg52. Phone number is 516-587, How to Write Your Own Book Club. And then he mentioned Adam also asked something about Naomi Osaka, the tennis player that had withdrew from the tournaments for mental health reasons. Well, you know, there's a few reasons. I'm not going to go into that question. But, you know, I mean, she had to keep doing these press conferences or she was going to get fined. So, yeah, she should withdraw. I mean, I think that was the right thing to do. You know, and it wasn't about money, but sometimes in entertainment and athletes, again, money becomes a situation. You know, I can't help but keep thinking about Kyrie, you know, whereas last year he was talking about boycotting, you know, playing basketball. He was one of the few that actually was like, no, we should just hold off and not play. But he went ahead and played, and now a year later, you know, he's getting fans throwing ice and cups and drinks at him. You know, being assaulted. You know, it's just, I think that whole entertainment and athlete, that's a really fine line to get into. But, of course, we don't have any time tonight. But I just say that I'm
Thank you.
Glad that she did yeah. that. I'm glad she did that for her own
well,
state of mind.
Well, that's a whole different show. That's
there.
A whole different
yeah.
show.
That's a whole
you
different
know, that,
show.
Getting into that question, that's a different show for a different time. We're talking about a historical perspective of massacres, you know, and that I'm sorry, man, but that had to take up the type of time it took up tonight, and we still only barely touched on it, man.
Yeah, I think that just came from you mentioned something about getting caught up in the entertainment, you know, losing the perspective and things like that. But in closing, I wanted to say something you mentioned last week, and I actually posted it. And you know, we're talking about these stories and we're talking about this history of America, you know, and we're looking at the beginnings and teaching from the beginnings would raise consciousness. And Dad, you said the failure to teach has justified this indifference, the malaise, the withdrawal that we're dealing with today.
Amen.
So again, we're scratching our heads. How the heck did we get here? Well,
yeah,
we're not, you know, our history is not being applied the correct way. So,
and we're not through being here either. You know,
and we're
like,
not through being here.
Yeah, how we got here is not God. How long does our getting here continue? You know,
I think we just lost a segment of our followers, right? Because it's 9 o'clock.
Yeah. That's the end of the show then for tonight. But like I said, ladies and gentlemen, our shows are live every Thursday. The Greenhouse Effect Radio Show is live Thursday night, 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. And Write Your Own Book Club is live every Saturday, 10 a.m. Saturday, 10 a.m. Central Standard Time. Look for Green BG52 or check out Write Your Own on the Facebook group page. Well, we got a little time. You got anything else in closing before we close it out, you know, before we get on out of here?
No, because I'm kind of open-ended right now, man. I'll just go on another rant. So the best thing we can do is mute me until next week, man. Thank you for the great show, man. You know,
you better
Adam, all
me.
Apologies to you, man. Yeah.
All right.
What'd
then,
you
so,
say, Will? I didn't hear that last part.
How you said, you better mute me. You better mute
yeah.
me.
Love
next
you, man.
Week, you know, we'll love you too, Dad. So next week we'll continue some of our discussion. I'm going to talk a little bit about, you know, even though this is some sad and dark moment, just remember to laugh. Laughter is the best medicine sometimes. So have a good night. Amen, everybody.
Amen. Amen.